Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with a very interesting man, Peter Bonney. Peter credits his disruptive childhood, a college education from UMass at Amherst, decorated on-the-ground service as a U.S. Army Special Operations Team leader in Vietnam, the love of his family and friends, plus his luck-of-the-draw DNA with making him the person he has become today. An author, donor-conceived rights advocate, and fun-loving grandfather. During his accomplished business career as a high-tech CEO, venture capitalist, board chairman, nonprofit leader, award-winning entrepreneur, and senior advisor, Peter has applied lessons of leadership through adversity. And that's a quote from his first book, an Amazon bestseller, All Hands on Deck, Navigating Your Team Through Crisis, Getting Your Organization Unstuck, and Emerging Victorious. Peter has also authored a second book, also a best-selling title, called Uprooted, where he intimately shares his personal odyssey and acquired expertise to advocate for regulatory oversight in the multi-billion dollar reproductive industry that conceives hundreds of half-siblings from a single donor, children and adults who are unaware of the existence of those half-siblings. So far, Uprooted has been twice recognized, first as the winner of the 2022 Best Book Award, Narrative Nonfiction by American Book Fest, and secondly, as a 2023 gold medal winner in the nonfiction audiobook category by the Independent Book Publishers Association. So first of all, Peter, thank you so much for your service in the U.S. Army and congratulations on the success of both of your books. We're going to spend a significant amount of time talking about the events that inspired your second book called Uprooted, and we'll talk about that. And I don't want to give too much away because I'd like people to support you by purchasing the book. They can find it on Amazon and several. You can get the audiobook, the Kindle, an actual hard copy. And, but we'll start there. Do you mind sharing your personal story and what inspired you to write your book?
Sure. Thanks, Callie. That all sounds much more impressive than it really is. And I'm still waiting for Oprah to call. She hasn't called yet. I think I need to be Bono or John Bon Jovi or something in order to get that call.
She should call you. It's worthy.
Well, we're still working on getting more visibility to this whole issue of donor conception.
Sure.
To answer your question, Callie, my story, it was 1995, and I was 49 years old, the CEO in Boston. And my mother had open heart surgery and a post-operative stroke. And that released all of the locks that guarded the chains that guarded her secret. So she spilled out that my dad, who was deceased for 33 years prior, was not biological. He was sterile. And I was conceived with the help of a anonymous sperm donor under the auspices of a somewhat clandestine fertility clinic under through Harvard Medical School. Mm. So run that by me again. Tell me that one more time. I mean, I really took my DNA for granted. I thought that there were three things that really made my my persona: a somewhat dysfunctional childhood, moved a lot. My dad was sick. Certainly a college education opened up more doors of opportunity than I could ever have imagined. And that service in Vietnam was, let's say it built my collaborative leadership style. But once again, I took my DNA for granted.
So what did you feel like when your mom kind of told you that? Did you, I mean, I'm certain that was pretty hard to believe and hard to hear.
I went through a range of emotions, and now that I've studied this, I find that the range of emotions that I went through are very typical of people that find that they are misattributed to one or both parents late in life for whatever the reason. So I was angry and relieved, happy, sad. I felt shame, pride, and everything under the sun, all at the same time. So that was confusing. It was conflicting, and it was traumatic. And believe me, it was traumatic.
Did you kind of said you felt a little bit of relief. And I'm wondering, when I've talked to other people who are donor conceived, they feel like something kind of clicks. Like they may have already always known something was awry, or they didn't feel like they had characteristics that were like the father that had raised them. And then when they found out that they were conceived, it kind of was like, oh, did you ever have that feeling?
Somewhat, Callie. I never fathomed that my dad was not my dad, but I was concerned about my health history. Mm-hmm. See, he suffered from fits of depression in 1962. There was no such thing as lithium or anything that could take care of that. And his last 4 years of his life, he was hospitalized in and out for that depression, and finally just took his own life. So let's say I was deeply impacted by that old school Italian family. Don't talk about suicide. It's a terrible shame on the family. Maybe felt a little bit inadequate and trying to prove that I was not inadequate, flawed in any way, shape, or form. So I was angry that I carried this with me and it was false, this fear that I had, and maybe made some decisions in my life consciously or subconsciously as a result of that, that I needn't have done. So I was angry and relieved all at the same time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to know that you didn't share that. But on the other hand, were you concerned at all about the health implications of not knowing who your genetic father was?
Well, you know, there's a term, genealogical bewilderment, and it raged within me. And believe me, it raged for 22 years. 1995, DNA was still 12 years away from being introduced by 23andMe as the invention of the year, according to Time magazine in 2008. And Ancestry.com was several years away in 2012 by the time they put out their product offering. So I had no place to go with this genealogical bewilderment. So I asked myself, what is my genealogy? You know, if I'm not Northern Italian, what am I? What's my health history? Well, that was a huge void. And I was raised as an only child. Did I have any siblings? Mm. Did I date a sibling or worse? So I had many questions in that regard.
Yeah. And you had to wait a long time. Well, maybe you're still waiting, but did you find answers with the invention of 23andMe and the like? You had to wait, one, a long time. And then two, did you ever get any closure and find out any of the answers to those questions?
Yeah, all of my questions have been answered thanks to DNA 22 years later. The only question that remains, Callie, is how many siblings do I have really? You know, I may never know the answer to that. And I'm a little concerned that I'm having, what kind of impact will that have on my children, my grandchildren, my yet to be great grandchildren? Mm-hmm. But the notion of feeling a little different, I did feel a little different in my family. And the older I got, the more my academic and my life's achievements were somewhat intimidating to members of my family, and on both sides, actually. And I didn't understand that. And of course, I was the tallest of any of my dad's family as well. He was 5'6". Most of his relatives in his bloodline were in that height range. So I was all of 5'10". Mm. Had those Northern Italian blue eyes, but nothing else.
So did you find out who then was your biological father?
Yes, it took a while. I did the DNA test on 23andMe in 2008. What I learned is, okay, I'm not Northern Italian on the paternal side. I'm English, French, and a sliver of Scandinavian. Well, I could live with that, but I couldn't find any DNA relative on the paternal side. And I thought, well, I'm brand new, 2008, let the customer base stack up a little bit and eventually I'll find them. And 9 years later, there was no paternal relatives on 23andMe. My then grown adult children came to me and said, you know, Dad, this isn't working for you. Take a look at ancestry.com. And they gave me a history lesson on how that went from family tree tools to DNA tools. And by 2017, their customer base actually exceeded the customer base of 23andMe, the market innovator. So in 2017, I spit for the second time in a vial and got the answers I was looking for with a close relative first cousin is what it said. But I learned that I found the source of my seed in that whole process.
Wow. And did you, oh, sorry, go ahead. I don't mean to cut you off.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, did you, in finding out who that was, I should ask first, if you established a relationship with that person, if they were still alive, and did you find any other relatives that you were able to establish a relationship with? And then if you did, my follow-up question then would be, did you see traits that you possessed that were very much like your biological paternal family?
All good questions, Callie.
I'm getting the cart in front of the horse. I have so many questions.
With some help, I did find the source of my seed. He was deceased. I have learned that I am one of five siblings so far. And I do have relationships with two of them. There are two that one doesn't want to know, and the other one has got his head in the sand and prefers not to know. Hmm. Now, like I said, the primary question is how many are there out there? I may never know. But I went through a research dive. My mother told me in 1995 at the Harvard Medical School, at the address of the fertility clinic, the name of the doctor. Well, she had a stroke, her memory wasn't all that good, and the address wasn't right, the name of the doctor wasn't right. So what I did, since there were no answers anywhere, I did a deep dive of research into the fertility field that helped enable my conception to begin with. And I ferried between Boston Public Library and Harvard Medical School's library and learned that many times in the past, the medical students were actually donors of sperm. So I went and got an alumni list of Harvard Medical School for the 4 years that they may have been there. And I was convinced that the name of my seed, the source of my seed, was in that list. What I found is that he had a loose affiliation with Harvard Medical School, but he was not a doctor. He was actually an engineer.
Mm.
My dad was a wannabe engineer. He dropped out of school, didn't have enough money back in the days of the Depression. So he became a tool and die maker. Now, I never had any mechanical acumen. I had other acumens, but not mechanical. So maybe that skipped a generation. My daughter is the one who's mechanical.
Wow. Wow. And I mean, I just can't imagine finding out this information while you're taking care of a mother who's not doing well as far as health is concerned, and kind of wrestling with learning this really life-altering information, and then not having the tools, because a lot of folks that I've talked to are younger and they could immediately go to the internet and immediately spit in a vial and kind of start sorting through this thing, through this. But to have to wait and to do all of that research and then to have this tool materialize and to just go through all that. And it sounds like your family, your kids were very supportive through that whole process. And you talk about, you did 2 decades of research during this time, this waiting on reproductive technology, which has changed so much in the last even 2 decades. What is something that you learned in that research maybe that surprised you the most, or something that you learned and you wish others would know about the industry?
Well, you know, I'm a businessman, and I looked at this from a vantage point of business. And there were 2 major drivers in this thing. Money certainly was a huge, huge driver. And the money was in 2 different buckets, I would say. One bucket was Frankenstein.
Okay.
And the other bucket was, let's go for Frankenstein first.
Okay.
I learned that artificial insemination was actually perfected in the late 19th century by a mad scientist, a Russian scientist, who really perfected it on the farm. So much so that now horses and prize horses could inseminate 500 instead of 30 naturally. So that was about the money. But he became Red Frankenstein, his nickname in history, because he had the vision of trying to create a hybrid man with an ape.
Hmm.
This is before science really understood the chromosomal limitations to human life.
Mm-hmm.
So when he inseminated 3 chimpanzees with human semen, that was one thing. But when he tried to inseminate 3 volunteer women with orangutan semen, Stalin said enough is enough and basically sent him out the gulag, where he died. And actually Pavlov gave his eulogy.
Hmm.
The other Frankenstein was a doctor who had experimented with artificial insemination with human in human form in the mid-1800s. And he's known as Nazi doctor of gynecology, is the modern inventor of modern gynecology. But he found his information through experiments on Black enslaved women with no anesthesiology.
Right.
Well, they answered many questions, but he was like the Joseph Mendel. The third Frankenstein was actually a Nobel Prize winner who was a eugenicist as well. And he advocated for the uplifting of humankind by controlling the seeds that get inseminated. And the last was actually a couple, a medical doctor and a lawyer, to put together the handbook of how to conceive with the donor insemination in secret, so that church and state couldn't push back on the idea. It was not illegal, but it was unethical. So my birth certificate was actually a fraud based upon that old practice, the old practice of not letting a doctor know that an obstetrician know that some artificial donor was there, some anonymous donor was there. That way the birth certificate could be signed by the doctor to say that the woman's husband was the source of the fatherhood.
Birth certificates now are still that way. They've become really just products of who's the parent / owner of the child, rather than the actual documentation of the child's medical being, who birthed the child, the donor egg or sperm, or, you know, that's still a complicated issue, is the issue of birth certificates.
Well, the first thing that drove this underground, in 1945, I found an article in Time magazine that was going over the legal definition of an artificially inseminated person. And they were going over the legal case in Cook County, Illinois, Superior Court, where a husband was granted a divorce from his wife on the grounds of adultery because she had a child through artificial insemination through a donor, even though he knew about it to begin with. And that child was declared illegitimate, and the marriage was given a divorce on grounds of adultery. Now, the title of that article was very telling. It was "Artificial Bastards" with a question mark. So you can see why the secrecy was involved in there, given the sociology at the time. "Bastard" as a working title for my book, actually.
It didn't end up going with that, huh?
Oh, my publisher was very good. They did a focus group on varying titles and gave me some options other than that. I still liked Artificial Bastard, but.
So how was your book received, and why did you feel the need to share your story in such a public way?
Well, I had done a good deal of research on the whole field that basically today conceives dozens, if not 100 or more, offspring from the same donor with nobody's knowledge, no sibling registry, no health history, no testing, counseling for donors or recipients about the needs of a donor-conceived child, no laws on the books to penalize blatant fertility fraud. I went over some of this with a friend of mine that used to breed Rottweilers, Kelly, and he gave me a view. He said, you know, there are more laws on the books, more legislative oversight to breeding puppies than conceiving human beings. So on that note, I thought this could be a thought-provoking book. But I was reluctant to tell my story until I finished my story. And in 2017, I was able to find the source of my seed, and I felt like my story was finished. But all of the disruptive feelings that I had in 1995 resurged again in 2017 when I finally learned the source of my seed. I had grieved for my father inadequately when he took his own life in 1962. I grieved again in 1995, and I was grieving again the third time in 2017. So I felt like to heal, I really needed to reveal. And it was not only a deeply intimate memoir that I wrote, but also a tell-all expose on an industry that really needs some reformation.
And how was it received? I've read some of your feedback on Amazon, but did it get... You talked earlier about how we still... The public at large still isn't really educated on this topic. And we really need to do more advocacy in this area. So did your book accomplish that goal? How was it received?
Well, I say it's work in process, Callie. It was received very well, recognizing two awards that it was given. I was very humbled by that. But once again,
Oprah, this is for you.
Oprah, this is for you, but Oprah hasn't called just yet. My goals for this book were threefold. I wanted to impact positively the practice of assisted reproductive technology. I'm all for science to enable wanting people to have a family. Mm-hmm. Just do so with those conceived people in mind. Secondly, I wanted to influence the legislative agenda towards what I'll call a donor-conceived Bill of Rights, the things that I mentioned to you about lacking anonymity and putting out information about genealogy and health history, limiting the numbers of offspring per donor, doing a sibling registry, mandating counseling, and putting some laws in the books about blatant fertility fraud, all the donor-conceived Bill of Rights. And lastly, speak to the needs and the emotional well-being of all people that might be misattributed, no matter the reason. donor conception back in the day was termed as semi-adoption, to sort of take away the negative taint of anonymous donors. But certainly the adoption community and the secrecy around that was lifted in the 90s. And here we have the fertility field not really taking into consideration the fact that anonymity is gone by the boards because of DNA analysis. It's been obsoleted anyway.
There's no such thing as anonymous donation anymore.
No.
Yeah. Which, as it should be. So it sounds like you think that regulation is really key to making this more safe.
Yes, we have sort of, it's off the rails now, in my view. There are two things putting it on steroids. One is just the internet. Social media, it's very much like Amazon.com and others have bypassed a cost of distribution in the business world. You've got the internet doing that today. So you can actually get sperm and egg donors via social media, bypassing any kind of regulatory oversight entirely. Can you imagine getting a credible sperm donor, for instance, from Craigslist?
No, I can't.
And the second thing that has put this in steroids is offshoring. Just like in business, manufacturing was offshored from high cost to low cost countries. You've got the fertility industry doing likewise, medical industry overall doing likewise. I have a friend that went to Costa Rica to get some dental work done, for instance, at a quarter of the cost. The same thing holds true with the fertility field, people going overseas to gain their insemination. There is also a field, it's almost trafficking, because, for instance, egg donors have been sourced by unscrupulous business interests with women from impoverished countries, for instance, in Eastern Europe, on the promise of money, taking away their health as well, and harvesting all of those eggs and sending them to other countries that still have anonymity as the prescription.
That's a big difference between, you know, sperm donation and egg donation, is that egg donation, and I hate those words donation because they're often paid for those services, so it's really not donation, but it's quite erroneous on a woman's body versus a male's body to give those gametes. So you bring up a good point there. And I agree. And surrogacy is another part of the fertility industry where people are going overseas to places that have, you know, lax legislation, and it's a little bit more affordable. And so they're using women in countries with a poor economic and poor legislation. So you hit on a really good point there.
Yeah, surrogacy as well. Rent a womb, for instance, in the Ukraine, it was a pretty big business. A woman from the Ukraine could make enough money to feed 100 children in her village for a year or more. And you have all of the internationalization complexity. There's foreign currency complexity. And what do you do when there's disruption in the supply chain thanks to war?
War.
So it's rent a womb from India, China, the Ukraine, wherever.
And you can have your egg from one country, sperm from another, and your womb from yet another.
That's right. And tell me about quality control on that one.
Yeah. Well, and
see,
our organization feels like one of the biggest things that people aren't thinking about, not only quality control, but what about the kids? How do they feel about all of this? You talked about bewilderment, and sure, we could have regulation, keeping donor registry, those sorts of things. But I maintain the stance that some things cannot be regulated, such as health risks. There's research showing that children born from frozen embryos are more likely or have a higher chance of having cancers later in life. Children born from IVF, which is required when you have any type of donor egg or sperm, studies are showing cardiovascular issues in those children. And that can't be regulated by law. You can't regulate health risks. And then also, just again, like you talked about the bewilderment, how do we begin to reconcile with children their creation, how they were, you know? It just kind of baffles me. Do you have any thoughts on that?
There is an Australian PhD, Dr. Damien Adams, you may have run across him, who's in process of studying now the health implications of many of these donor-conceived children through their frozen gametes. How long were the gametes frozen? What impact does it have on their health? And he's got some alarming statistics that he's been making more visible and doing more studies on them as well. So there's many things that we just don't know about using 10-year-old, 20-year-old, 50-year-old now frozen gametes as an example. Now, back during my conception, the freezing wasn't technologically available. So I'm a product of a live fire exercise. Since my parents apparently used a very ethical physician who was not using his own sperm, likely to find that I have 100 siblings, but I just don't know how many that are out there really.
Can you give an idea of the numbers of how many donor conceived people there are?
Yeah, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine did a study in 2010, and they're American in name only, since they have 25% of their membership is actually in other countries. And it seems to be the aggregate way for a typical trade association to do networking and education for their members, remembering they're also a lobbyist working for public policy to eliminate the requirements of regulation and be a free market enterprise. And their study was that in 2010, there were about 1 million donor-conceived children, according to their surveys. Now, they also expected, they forecast that some 30 to 60,000 new children would be born each year through donor insemination. Now, I did do the math on that and take the midpoint. That means that we have a 50% increase, 50% increase in the numbers of donor-conceived people just in the last decade. So now not 1 million, but 1.5 million. And that's according to survey, how many more are out there that the survey didn't touch or didn't tap. At the same time, we have studies showing that the fertility rates in the Western Hemisphere are down how much? 50%. In the last four decades, thanks in part to a toxic environment and the fact that people are waiting longer and the biological clock isn't working for them. So the 50% up to 50% down. We also have a sociological shift. Now, only 20% of those using donor gametes are heterosexual couples. 40% are same-sex couples, and 40% are single people. So the sociology has changed radically.
Well, and interestingly, there are laws that are changing on this as we speak. I just wrote a letter about one in California that's trying to change the definition of infertility to include people who couldn't have children biologically, to include, let's say, for example, gay men, they would be considered infertile. And this change in definition is so that these folks can utilize their health insurance to use assisted reproduction, to access donor gametes and women who will be surrogate mothers. So I only imagine that the numbers of donor conceived people will increase if these laws keep changing and we don't kind of wake up to the consequences of this.
Well, the consequences is the big thing. Also in California, a donor-conceived Bill of Rights was put before the governor's desk this past year with all those categories of no more anonymity, et cetera. And the governor refused to sign that. His reason stated was that he did not want the state to absorb the expense of a sibling registry. So that's back to the drawing board now. Wow. The state of Colorado was the first state to actually pass a donor-conceived Bill of Rights last year. We have 12 states now that at least have some laws in the books regarding blatant fertility fraud to analyze that legally. Now, this is like Chinese water torture. You know, it's step by step by step, state by state by state, with a variety of baby bills doing one particular aspect of the donor-conceived Bill of Rights or the other particular aspect of the donor-conceived Bill of Rights. I have been donating proceeds from my book to two nonprofits that are working in the advocacy field to execute that donor-conceived Bill of Rights. Now, they're believing that the state-by-state-by-state approach will add some momentum to enable a federally mandated donor-conceived Bill of Rights. I'm a little impatient, and I'm looking for some federal legislation on this.
It's hard because not much else at all in the fertility industry is regulated at a federal level either. So surrogacy is also a patchwork of laws, some states having really no laws on it, others having, you know, quite liberal ones like the state of California. So I think that you've got your work cut out for you, but I think that it's an admirable quest, to say the least. But
you know, the United States is a little behind where other countries are, Australia, the UK, New Zealand, as examples of folks that have been a little bit more progressive in their viewpoint of putting this under some degree of regulation and control. I mean, here we have the SEC and the FDA and the FCC, and I'll give you more initials, to understand that industries don't police themselves all that well, and they're really being regulated for the public good. But here is the fertility field with no regulation at all, free to conceive dozens, if not 100 or more siblings from the same donor with nobody's knowledge.
Yeah.
It's long.
And you have organizations like that you talked about, the ASRM, who's putting out guidelines, but it's a little bit of a... what do you say? I'm blanking on the term, but you know, they're benefiting from the industry that they're also writing their recommendations for. So
happy that they're putting out some guidelines and recommendations. There are guidelines and recommendations. They're not laws.
Right.
Let's go over one of the guidelines. A guideline is 25 offspring per donor per 800,000 population. Well, that's fine. If I lived in Sacramento, I could have 25 siblings. But how about in metropolitan Boston, using that guideline, I'd have 125 siblings. Mm-hmm. But in Los Angeles or New York City, a more populated area, using that guideline, I'd have 250 siblings. That is just not a realistic guideline.
Right, right. Well, and you talk about Australia and others kind of being ahead of the game, but I spoke with a mother who used donor conception for her daughter, and she now advocates against it as well, because she was saying that although there are laws and limitations, etc., there are very creative ways of working around, and they're really not people, they're not abided by the fertility industry there. So it's hard to say if they're actually even working.
Yeah, there's that super sperm donor from Holland, I believe, that has now 1,000 siblings. And he was ordered by the courts to cease and desist unless he wants to be fined. Well, find me. Hey, find me.
Right.
No law in the books for that. So some things, it's more difficult.
Yeah. And really, bottom line to me, too, and like we hear about these stories, I'm just frustrated for the children because we have just zero disregard for how any of this affects them, their well-being, their health, their, you know, and it's just, it really makes me frustrated and sad.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. So I'm working, I feel confident, actually. I'm confident that some laws on the books will continue to come forward. Unfortunately, it will take more and more visibility to atrocities of people with 1,000 siblings and something going wrong with the siblings or siblings marrying one another or something along that line to get more visibility. But, you know, today we have 50 million people in the customer base worldwide, globally, of the DNA companies, 50 million. Now, the experts, in quotes, the experts believe that some 2-4% of the Western Hemisphere is misattributed for some reason. Some make a case, very cogent case, that the number is much larger than that. Others make a case that, well, that's a little smaller than that. Well, how much smaller than 2-4% are you going to get? But they'll say, okay, 4% is a good talking point, all right? Mm-hmm. So now it's 50 million people, 4%. In my high school graduating class of 100, using that 4% number, four of them would be misattributed. I know I'm one of them. Two of them have come to me and said, hey, we're confused about our DNA testing results. Can you help me understand it? And I know there's one more out there. So that's four. All right. That's corroborated by my high school class. But it's bigger than this. You have how many parents? You have two parents, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How many grandparents?
Four.
How many grandparents? Great grandparents.
Eight.
Exponential in number. So if I can use this geometric proportion, that means that my entire high school graduating class of 100, all 100 of them are misattributed to someone in between their third and sixth great grandparent. At 2-4% swing.
Right.
All right. So all of those stories about maybe the Mayflower might be true, but maybe they're not true. Why wouldn't it be true? Well, you have covered up adoption, closed adoption, certainly an extramarital affair, sexual assault, switched at birth. Maybe you thought Aunt Martha was your mom, but Cousin Mary was your mom. You were brought up by another member of the family. Mm-hmm. That happens in families even today. So there's a variety of reasons that somebody could be misattributed. And the more the customers... The larger the customer base in the DNA circle, the more these things come out. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing newspaper article after newspaper article after newspaper article recently about these varying things. So let's get 100 million people in that customer database instead of 50 million people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
More and more atrocious stories that are discovered out there and more disruption and more trauma to be experienced in this misattribution mm-hmm. by late discovery.
So you do advocacy work now. Do you help other people who are starting their journey? Like you helped your friends with their understanding their results on Ancestry. Cause I can, from what I've heard, it can be kind of confusing to kind of trace these lineages. What other work do you do besides sharing your story and writing your book and helping your friends with their lineage? What things do you do?
Other than sailing my boat and having a good time and
yes,
happy grandfather. My message board on my Facebook page oftentimes lights up with questions and so forth. And I'm I have only a limited bandwidth, so I'm trying to work with the advocacy organizations. That's a way to get to multiply my efforts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I found that if you want to run fast, you run alone. But if you want to go far, you go with others. So I'm trying to go a little further and trying to leverage that with the organizations too.
Mm-hmm. And which organizations?
I'm working with the U.S. Donor Conceived Council. That's an affiliation of We Are Donor Conceived, the Facebook support group. Mm-hmm. And one called Right to Know that is doing a good deal of advocacy and has a good successful track record in the fertility fraud legislation on a state-by-state basis. U.S. Donor Conceived Council got an early success with the Donor Conceived Bill of Rights passed in the state of Colorado. So my notion is that success breeds success. So I'll keep on going there.
Good, good. And I just want to remind listeners and watchers, viewers, that you can pick up Peter's book on Amazon in all the possible ways you can read a book, through your Kindle device, through an actual hard copy of the book, and through audiobook, which is what I have. Peter, are there any other ways that people can get your book besides Amazon?
Go to your local bookstore. If they don't have it in stock, you can order it.
Great. And people can find you on Facebook, from what I understand. Is that the best place? And where else can they find you? I think you have a website, right? PeterBoney.com. Is that a good resource for our listeners?
www.PeterJBoney.com. The middle initial in there. I find that there's an Australian also named Peter Bonney, spelled the same way, that he has a website too. So trying to eliminate confusion, PeterJBonney.com.
Yes. So if you find the Australian, that is not our Peter. Peter is in the United States. And then is that the same for Facebook, Peter Bonney on Facebook as well?
Well, if you go to my website, it has all the connections.
Perfect.
To Facebook and Twitter and Instagram, as well as my own page.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So our time is coming to an end. So I just want to take a minute and thank you so much for having you come on the show to share a little bit of your story. I really hope that our listeners and our viewers will go buy your book so they can find out more about you, about your story, and about the fertility industry as it relates to donor conception. So thank you for joining us and sharing your work here on Venus Rising.
I'm happy to, Kelly. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes. I'd like to thank each and every listener and subscriber, as always, for tuning in. Our goal is to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.